We're 10 days away from spring. And I would say it puts a little spring in my step, but no, it just gives me a little faster shuffle. I love spring. I hope you do. This thing here, this will probably work all right. I probably need to activate another one. This battery is probably low and it doesn't show. How many of you are acquainted with SAD syndrome? All right, how many of you have it? The seasonal affective disorder. If you look it up in the dictionary, my picture is definitely there. I don't get DJ. I didn't know you were here. He snuck in. I don't get depressed. I just maintain the same level of lethargy all the time. But it does affect my energy level. And I don't care what the doctors say to me. It's just an imbalance in your serotonin level. I don't really care. I just know when winter comes, I understand why bears go into hibernating. There's nothing that happens until spring comes. Well, actually, you may say, well, you did put on 30% more fat just for hibernation. Well, that may be true, but it's okay for me to say, but I hope you don't agree too quickly. But a lot of people are affected by that. Some people go into a deep depression. And as I looked at that, I thought, it's not the cold I mind. It's the darkness. I just hate it with a passion. As a matter of fact, at night, if I'm reading and I happen to doze off, I'm more comfortable in my recliner chair than the bed. It keeps me at a level that I'm more comfortable with. I'll just sleep through the night with the lights on. I much prefer that, at least in the wintertime. But this darkness just gets to me. As a matter of fact, I think I mentioned before, I don't have much use for sleep either. I think I told somebody sometime, my view is that sleep was developed for people who do not have enough goals in life. I'll finally wrap things up on my computer visuals at 2:15 in the morning. Then I'll sit down and read a book for 45 minutes. And if I can get 5 hours of sleep someplace in there, generally I'm all right. But I want to draw a contrast between what is true in the physical realm, because a lot of us who have this disorder, we just hate the darkness. But in the spiritual realm, the opposite is true. People love the darkness. And of course, Mark, how about activating that other pointer on the back there? Looks like this is giving up the ghost. Anyway, John chapter 3, verse 19. And this is a condemnation: the light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light because their deeds are evil. Now, that's understandable. I put a little burglar there because he likes to ply his trade when nobody else can see. Yeah, there are a lot of arrogant ones out there who sometimes break into houses in the middle of the day because they can do it quickly. But as a general rule, they don't want to be caught, and they don't want the shame of people knowing what they're doing. So as you look at this burglar here, he hates the light because his deeds are evil. Would you turn to 2 Timothy chapter 3. In that passage, and I'm afraid I'll miss one or two words, I'll just take the time to read it. Know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. Now, Paul wrote this 2,000 years ago. Is it not a commentary on today? Because men don't change, and women don't change. Don't want to leave you women out. When I'm talking something that's not flattering, you may prefer to be left out and blame it on us fellows, but we're all in the same boat. We're all humans together. So men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, You ever see such a materialistic society? Boasters, proud, talking about arrogance, blasphemers, people who just have no qualms about taking God's name in vain, disobedient to parents and all other authority. I mean, it's just us, isn't it? Unthankful, unholy. Boy, we're an entitled bunch of people. And this is rubbed off on Christians, where we think our brand of Christianity in America is the same kind of Christianity that people throughout the world will have. Ask the people who are suffering a little bit of a power outage. By the way, anybody here who still needs to get their power back? I think John was one of the last, and you, last Thursday, was it Wednesday, Thursday? Yeah, well, but fortunately, John had a little cottage in the back where they could have a little fire and stuff. That would be a luxury. Of course, the fact that the water wasn't hot was not a luxury, but we take it for granted. We're in the top 3% of the richest people in the world, even the average American. But we're unthankful. When was the last time you praised God? Just walking down the road, sidewalk, driving along. Does it come to your mind all the time to thank God for all the things he's given you and what he's protected you from? Now, if you're like I am and you say, I don't even think it was last Wednesday or Thursday, it may have gone a couple weeks, that's too long. Wouldn't you agree? God is worthy of praise. Unloving, unforgiving, I mean, broken relationships all over, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. Boy, that's us all over. Having a form of godliness but denying its power, and from such turn away. Now notice verse 6. For of this sort are those who creep into households and make captives of, old King James says, silly women, loaded down with sins, led away by various lusts, always learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Now the reason I'm pointing this out is that word creep. They creep into houses. And the word they're taking, take captives. I thought, no, wait a minute. Sounds like kidnapping, doesn't it? No. It's taking advantage of, or the idzo verb in the original language, is a verb which means to captivate. A fast talker who's captivating. Anyway, they creep into houses, taking advantage of women, gullible women. And by the way, if you're dating somebody who's feeding you a line, don't be so gullible as to take everybody at face value. You have to get to know them. Don't marry them just because they showed you some attention. As a high school principal, boy, I think of some of the most talented young ladies who made such lousy choices in a life mate. Now they're divorced, have kids at home. It's tough, isn't it? Don't be deceived by what people tell you. Take long enough to see how they live. That tells you more about what really is in the heart. In this passage, they take advantage of gullible women, and then the participle here is piling, having piled sin upon sin and having been led away by various lusts. Now, I don't know about you, but I've worked in jobs where it didn't take me long to understand that the men that I worked with, in fact, the only way you can say it is their minds were in the gutter. The only thing they could talk about was their sexual exploits without any morals at all in our culture. Well, men love darkness. And you can rest assured that when they get involved in those things, they're going to do their best to keep it a secret. They're going to rent a motel, even if they go that far, someplace out of town. They're going to make sure that they very furtively make arrangements where nobody else sees them because they don't want their marriage to break up. They don't want their job to be jeopardized. They just don't want the public exposure. But it doesn't change the fact that they love darkness, in which they can engage in things that Paul would say would be shameful to speak of. So you and I need to understand that that is the culture. How many of you have been to the Grand Canyon? How many of you have gone on the little burro or donkey or mule down the side? I refuse to trust my life to any animal smaller than me. I mean, I see some of those roads in Colombia. You know, these narrow little roads where the only way you can get past is for somebody to get in the dirt over here, and then these big trucks get on the side, and you can look 500 and some feet down. I mean, that was terrifying. The Grand Canyon, nah, I don't think I'm going to take the burro ride. But the fact of the matter is, if you analyze the Grand Canyon, you'll see that the sediment that was built up there, Walter Brown says it could have happened within 3 weeks, which is true when you're talking about sheet erosion and how this works very easily from the Grand Lake hitting Hopi Lake and then the deluge that went out over. It didn't take long for the Grand Canyon to form. You said, that doesn't sound scientific. I don't care. If it's true, it's true, whether scientists agree with it or not. But the fact of the matter is, these are laid up in layers. And you can see there, if you take the burro ride, or if you climb down in there, oh, that's all right. I've got control and I didn't know it. By the way, this is a new one that has a blank screen on it. And it's right where the advanced slide was on the other one. So, Alex, look what you have to look forward to when you go back to using visuals again. But anyway, here we are at the top. And as you descend down through there, there is a different strata demonstrating different things. Now, it just so happened up here, see how dark it gets down there? Now, I'm just going to tie that in to a spiritual application. When you go from the top to the bottom, you're just descending into the depths. No great thing. It's just a physical illustration. But spiritually, here's the application. When man fell way back here, there were certain consequences that took place. At the same time, before they were even kicked out of the garden, God says, I'm going to put a ray of hope into this whole thing. I'm going to send a redeemer, the seed of the woman, who will crush the head of the serpent, even though he himself will sustain a wound to the heel. God didn't do anything more to explain it, but he's simply saying, I don't have to have a plan B, because my plan A was a lamb slain from before the foundation of the world. God knew what would happen. He knew what great price it would pay. But here mankind is out of the garden. Now what does he do? Where does he go? Well, the fact of the matter is, I've put a picture here, that he can decide to follow God's way, going back to God's redemption, or other people here with the light taken away from them, they just descend farther and farther and farther into the darkness, going down all kinds of strata of evil deeds and depravity. So up here, what God stood for is divine authority, his honor, the standards of his holiness, justice and equity in the way you treat other people, obedience, that is the person following and acknowledging God, and morality based on God's standards. Now, I could put 20 things in there, but these are hard enough to read anyway. I just want us to get the point that in God's realm, there are things that reflect God's character. And those who decided to follow God's way had God's approval. His faith was counted for righteousness. Genesis, I think, 26:5 makes it clear that God chose Abraham because he said, I know that Abraham will follow my commandments, my statutes, and my ordinances. God chooses those who honor him. There's a reason he chose Jacob over Esau. You see the two characters? God knew at birth what would happen. So he chooses the one who would follow his covenant. So as you and I look at what happened here, people have already decided that they don't need God. They're going to go their own way of pleasure. starts out a certain way, but it doesn't matter what order you put them in. But it starts with a disregard for God and God's standards. Romans chapter 1, since they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind. You see, when you're talking about judicial blindness, it always starts with man's previous rejection of the truth. You will not find an exception to that. And I studied that, and I took some extra time studying that because, well, a number of reasons. But when you go back to Isaiah and other places, you will find that in every instance, they rejected the truth. So God, and it's in effect what they were doing is they love the darkness, and they look at the flashlight of the rescue party, and they say, get that light out of here, because it hurts their eyes. And God says, okay, if you don't want the light, let's just go to somebody else who is willing to be helped. So it's not that God changes their spiritual mind or understanding. They can be left in blindness when God withdraws the light. Because God wants all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth. So if people are destined for hell, it's because of their own choice, not because of something they were predetermined to do. So they didn't respect God. They disobeyed God. They engaged in wickedness. And then anarchy and lawlessness, which is where we are in Judges. And then moral perversion. That's just what will happen when people leave God out of the picture. But fortunately, you and I who are believers here have a treasure in earthen vessels. So God wants people to be saved. So he has left us here to be children of light. We're light in the darkness. So not only by the scriptures and the truth that we declare to people, you don't have to quote verses to them all the time. Just tell them what the truth is. And then also, I enlarge this here to, instead of being just around the torch, to show that my life often is a witness to the truth. And as a matter of fact, if my life doesn't agree with what I say, it nullifies the effectiveness of what I'm trying to tell people. If my faith doesn't work for me, why should they then listen to me when I say it will work for them? And sometimes this is undermined tragically. So you and I are down here. The people around you may be relatives. They may be co-workers. They may be neighbors. They may be people you just can't come into casual contact with. We do not have a mindset. We don't have the heart of God to be aware that these people around us are hurting spiritually. So sometimes we go our own little way, figuring, hey, life is good. Well, it's not going to be good for them if those who have the truth keep the truth from them. And it's not easy, and it hurts. If I were to say, how many of you have been ridiculed at your place of business because you were the Christian and you stood for something that they didn't have a use for? Do they call you deacon or some other term? Well, the fact of the matter is, it's always tough, but it's always a privilege to be God's representative. There are two views of the truth. The secular view, you can see there. I'm not going to read all this stuff to you. But the idea today is, truth is what you discover. So what they've done is, if you look at philosophy, they've taken John Stuart Mill's utilitarianism, the greatest good for the greatest number, that is what is socially good for people. They blend that with William James's pragmatism, what is good for you. And then they say, you can develop your own truth. You can decide what's true for you. Now, it may be some of the dumbest stuff you've ever heard in your life, but people will usually construct their truth around what will meet their greatest desires or needs. So it's not surprising that people come up with some really weird and crazy views, but one of the things that the secular world will say, there is no such thing as authority in the truth of this book because we don't acknowledge God's authority and we don't even acknowledge that that's his word to start with. The fact of the matter is, realism is based upon what's true. And it's true whether people accept it as true or not. You don't build truth from a bunch of bricks and rocks just lying around like a smorgasbord. I'll choose this and I'll construct a wall of truth. No, the truth is more like an unbreakable rock. If you want to find some of those, go into fence building. And start to drill down, and you get down there 6 inches. I'm talking about Lacey Springs in Rockingham County. And you hit a complete sheet of shale. Man, that's tough. The truth is like a bedrock. You can't break it. All you can do is remove the dirt from on top. The dirt of wrong ideas that will be obscuring it. And sometimes we Christians forget that we fall into the trap of the world. I read a book about 40 years ago, and I remember one or two things in there that I went to refresh myself. Fortunately, I found it again. C.S. Lewis had a student who became more of Lewis became his mentor. His name was Harry Blumeritz. And Lewis encouraged him to write a book. I didn't realize it until I just opened the front of it just to see. Having worked in book business for so many years, I'm interested in dates and copyrights and all that stuff. Lewis, Aldous Huxley, John F. Kennedy all died November 22nd, 1963. And I noticed a copyright in the book that Lewis recommended that Blumeritz write was also 1963. I wasn't sure when in the year it was, but he called it The Christian Mind. And I didn't go back and reread the whole thing, but I read two chapters in it on the nature of truth and the nature of evil. Kind of dated in some ways, but he had some really interesting things to say in there. And one of the things he mentions is that quite often we lose because we play the secularist game using secular arguments and secular methods. Now, I already knew that. Well, what did he mean by that? He didn't go into a lot of detail, but essentially he was saying that we wind up matching opinions. We don't state it as the truth. We don't say, God says. We simply say, I think. So he said he noticed in England, way back when, that on BBC, British Broadcasting, BBN, network, that somebody would take a quote from some notable church leader. But whenever they broadcast it, they always made sure that they went down the street and found Betty the dressmaker and Harry the butcher and somebody else and asked their opinion about what this religious leader had said. Then when it was posted, all of them had equal time. So guess what? What this churchman had said, which was supporting the truth, was more than offset by the opinions of three people in the street who didn't know beans about God's truth. Well, they would say, I think this, or, well, that's no longer relevant. Well, is that any way to find out what the truth is? So when you're talking to someone, I've said this 3 and 4 and 5 times, I hope you're careful with the way that you present the truth to them. Because when they ask you or they don't ask you, if you've got opportunity, that's fine, go ahead and present the truth. Don't ever, by the way, I'm overstating this, don't ever say, well, I think that. No, no, you've lost the argument because you're in the minority. Political correctness and the surveys will say people no longer believe that. That was way for way back then. And the minute you say, well, I think, you've fallen into their trap because what they're doing is they say, I think this is true. It works for me. Remember months ago when we had the article that had to do with Oxford Dictionary putting a new word in the dictionary called truthiness, which means it's not necessarily what is true. It's what people believe is true. And perception with many people is everything. So if you're going to establish a truth by some political poll or some majority consensus or from some legislative decree, you may be far, far off the mark from what the truth really is. And yet people will just gullibly follow some significant other person. And unfortunately, they've got plenty of leaders in some churches that agree with them. And that just gives them support. So God's truth is unchangeable. It is absolutely authoritative. And when you say or hear people who say, well, that was for the New Testament times, but, you know, God has changed or his word has changed. No, no, no. Don't fall into that trap either. Sometimes you just have to state the truth and allow the truth to do its work of being planted in that person's heart, because you will not necessarily be able to win the argument. You're not called upon to convince people. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, knowing therefore the terror of the Lord, we persuade people. I'm not saying that we don't have a sense of urgency, but I am saying that the work of conviction and enlightenment belongs to God's Spirit. And unfortunately, we have the idea we have to beef ourselves up on all the latest views of apologetics to convince the intellectual person that what we have to say is true after all. No, this word is able to accomplish its purpose, no matter how feeble or how inadequate I am or how I feel. If I have deep convictions, then the world will stand up and take notice. They may ridicule that. Eric Little was one of those. It was 1924 in the Olympics there. The Prince of Wales even asked him to run on Sunday, and as a Presbyterian, he said, no, that's against my convictions. Well, imagine that. Be a patriot, fella, and run for your country. He said, no, I've got a little bit higher authority than that. Now, by the way, today we would laugh at that, wouldn't we? A lot of sports are held on Sunday. I'm not going to make a commentary on that one way or the other. I'm simply saying that when he said no, the world took notice. And it was blazing across the headlines of the world that here was a believer who was standing up for his convictions, even though in the next sentence they could have said, isn't it hilarious that somebody still believes that? They didn't do that because they respected the man who had integrity. Now, that doesn't mean, well, 1 Peter chapter 4 says, you and as Christ suffered for us in the flesh, we're to arm ourselves with the same mind. And then it goes on to say that people think it's strange that we don't run with them to the same, Old King James, excess of riot. We don't allow ourselves to be dragged into what they find fun anymore. They think it's strange. And notice in Peter chapter 3, verse 10, that they're embarrassed when they speak evil of us. Now, as we're going through the Gospel of John, Daryl was bringing out some points. But the fact of the matter is, they rejected Christ, the leaders did anyway, because they had their own agenda. So as you and I are speaking the truth, let's do it with compassion. But let's not budge an inch with what is true, because we lose our voice to speak when we do that. Now, back in Judges chapter 17, we see this pattern reach its fruitful harvest. That is, we see apathy. We see that developing into my personal control of everything, my autonomy, and then that leads to anarchy, because you can't have everybody living for himself. One of the basic principles in a pluralistic society is that I exercise freedom up to the point that another person's freedom starts. I don't intrude into their space. Now, that means I have to give up doing some things I would like to do. They have to give up doing some things they like to do, but it's the only way you can get together. But when you've got them running rampant, everybody saying, I'm number one, and you should bow down to me, it's not going to happen. So, in Judges chapter 17, this is one of those places in verse 6. I'll come back to this in a minute. In those days, there was no king in Israel. everyone did what was right in his own eyes, and then it's repeated several verses later. Now, I've used this one time before, but this is important. And that is, why are we where we are today? Everybody here, I think, has heard of the second generation syndrome. Okay. We know that God's pattern is that I submit my faith and life to Him in personal faith. I have an experience with God, and that is based on ongoing relationship. Out of that, I praise God. I maintain my commitment to Him, and I obey Him in everything He wants me to do. Now, part of the challenge of being a parent is if you have deep convictions, you would love to see your kids have those same convictions. But you see, they're humans. It's not necessarily guaranteed. But when you and I share the light and bring them up into the nurture and admonition of the Lord, it means that that's one of the major parts of encouraging that young person to share our values. You know, you wouldn't have to be in a principal's office very long for you to see some of those young people sitting there, sons and daughters of church leaders, who couldn't speak of their parents without gritting their teeth because they rejected everything their parents stood for because their parents used the Bible as a club over their head, or the parents were not consistent. They were putting on a front at church, and then at home, the kids saw what they're really like. In other words, the faith that their dad and mom professed was not working for them. Therefore, who are you to shove it off onto me? It's a whole different kind of battle out there. And you hold your breath because the battle is never won. You think, man, when they get to be 18, they're out on their own. No, they're not. They keep coming home. And sometimes they bring their problems with them. But hopefully, as parents, 2 John, in that short letter, John says, I rejoice when I hear that my children, spiritual children, walk in the truth. My kids aren't perfect. They took after Charlotte. Well, took after Charlotte anyway. By the way, she gets back at me at home. Any of you ladies want equal time, she will meet you in the library right after service. You need a sense of humor when you're married, don't you? But to be able to look at your kids and thank God that despite the problems they might have had, they seem to have a spiritual sensitivity. That's a privilege. But the battle's never won. Things can still happen. So we parents keep praying. Because even though parenting in the home might be done, mentoring in their life continues. Because that'd be your disciple for as long as you live. So what the Lord wants to do is He wants us to share those with our children in such a way that those values become theirs. Now, Don can explain this much easier than I can. I didn't realize there was as much to a baton race as there is. In high school, I watched a time or two. I helped Doug Fisher with his discus throwing when I become, he did, not me, state champion. Boy, that fella could throw a discus. But anyway, I saw the baton race. And I thought all you had to do is just kind of start out and run as fast as the other fella to minimize fumbling and grab the baton and finish. I didn't realize there were rules. Used to be that as that fella came up, the new fella would have 10 meters to pick up speed, called an acceleration zone, and then they had 20 more meters to actually pass the baton. And that's where a lot of the things are lost, because they fumble it. Well, as of November last year, they combined the two together. So it's a combination zone for them to pass it off. So if I'm successful as a parent, if we church leaders are successful with folks that we're in touch with, and if you are successful with people that you have an influence with, we'll see Christ said, every disciple, when he is fully trained, will be like his master. So when they call the disciples Christians, it's because, again, they walk like Christ, they talk like Christ, and they have the image of Christ impressed upon them. People ought to be able to look at us, and even if they're sneering when they do it, they ought to understand to whom we belong. We belong to God. Now, down here, here's where the problem is. How many people do you know who are fine, upstanding Christians, and, you know, no reason to doubt it, but something happened that they didn't have a successful handoff to their children, and their children became a total disgrace? We never, ever said to our kids, behave because what will people think? Because your dad's a school principal, your dad is a pastor, your dad is an elder in the church. That was a lousy reason. We want them to understand they follow God because of a personal conviction, because God's standards stood on their own merit. You give them a false reason, they find a way around it, then that gives them the okay to do whatever they want. I think of Billy Sunday. I don't know how many people that man preached to. Not as many as Billy Graham, of course. By the way, Franklin had a lot of problems. He was a total disgrace to the Graham family for a number of years until he repented. But the fact of the matter is, Billy Sunday was away preaching evangelist crusades, and I'm not going to analyze what happened, but I do know that when his three sons died on their deathbed, they spent their last words cursing the name of God. What could happen? Well, God has no grandchildren. Just because you're a believer doesn't mean that your kids will automatically be. So somewhere along the line, they fumble. So if they don't have a personal experience with God, now they become their own gods, admiring themselves in the mirror, characterized by ingratitude and compromise and secularism and rebellion. That's called the second generation syndrome. When values of one generation will not be given to the next generation. In the book of Judges, by the way, I'm well aware of where the clock is, that's okay. We've already covered these things here where their apathy, their willing to settle, meant they didn't complete everything God wanted to do. And then they went into captivity as they practiced sin. But then here, beginning in chapter 17, the fruit of that is social lawlessness. Now, we're right here in our culture. We've seen it happen, the pattern play out all over again. And the first thing here is religious paganism. Now, I'm not going to recount this whole story. I'll let you read it. But it's a story in which there was a man in Ephraim, which is Joshua's home territory. Joshua dies, saying to them in Joshua 24:15, you can choose whatever God you want to serve, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And all the people who respected Joshua followed the Lord as long as Joshua lived, and for all the elders who outlived Joshua. So he was an influential man. But there was a man, Micah, who decided, well, it's too far to travel probably down to Shiloh, where the tabernacle was, so he's going to start his own religion. So he makes idols, sets them up, and then he finds this Levite, who's, by the way, not authorized to be a sacrificing priest, and he developed his own little religion. So as you put the story together, this is from a couple scenes in there. Could go into a lot of detail about that, but it doesn't add any more to it, except to simply say that in this culture, which has already ruled out God, you're left with people who become their own authorities. But there is something in man that is created to recognize God. You can't get away from it. He's going to worship something. So if he's already said the God who is a creator is not one that will worship, then they're going to create something else that they can worship. So here he takes all this money and makes these idols, set them up in his house, and then hires his own paid-for hireling leader or Levite to go ahead and practice the ritual for him. Now, let's wrap this up quite quickly. How many of you are aware of Nikki Haley, former governor of what, South Carolina, tapped to be the ambassador to the United Nations? Now, this is not a political example. I want to assure you of that. But I admire this woman tremendously because she will not back down. She had a lot of conservative values she defended as governor of South Carolina. And then when she went to the United Nations, if you followed it at all, man alive, she could be hooted down by almost every other nation in the world, and she's going to stand there for Israel. Fearless. As a matter of fact, her book, Can't is Not an Option. I admire that. But whose voice is she? As the ambassador, she speaks that which she is authorized to speak by the higher authority, which is the United States, as represented by the president. If she works within those guidelines, she can pretty much say most anything she wants and get an audience. But the minute she quits speaking for the policy of our country, she may as well hand her resignation in. But she's going to speak for it. If it's a biblical thing she's standing for, she's going to speak for it, even if she does have to hand her resignation in under a certain president. So I look at Nikki Haley and say, hey, go for it. She's just received recognition all over. She's a faithful ambassador. All right, do you know him? Oh, yeah. I thought about not putting the names up there. Edgar Bergen, by the way, was a very marginal ventriloquist. It disturbs me when I can see their mouth moving. But he was one of the first ones on the market with Charlie McCarthy, and he was the only game in town for a lot of years. Now let me ask you a question. Whose voice came out of this dummy's mouth? Any great thoughts a dummy had? No. Whatever Edgar Bergen put into his mouth. So, he's a thoughtless puppet. Now, my question is, whose voice are we? Do we speak on behalf of a higher authority and maintain the policy, the truth of God, regardless? Or do we let the world put its hands up our back through whatever slot there is there and speak through Christians in the Christian church? Boy, I see some churches out there that are going to be really, 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 really accountable before the Lord because they have called good what God has called evil. And they're ordaining homosexuals into the ministry, which has always been, always will be, a perversion and abomination to God. Now, that's a truth that doesn't change. At no point can you say, well, that was for the time being. Won't go any further into that. But there's a lot of things that the press will go and find some liberal person who happens to be a church member and let them spout off liberal philosophy, pagan philosophy, and say, see, we got the church on our side. What a horrible thing to do. God's truth is under attack. Well, let's go back for just a minute. As long as we're the clear beacon shining into the world, we're doing our job. But if we allow the world to put its voice, its values, its vices, its practices into the church, into the life of a Christian, then guess what? The message is obscured. Now, if people were to look at you and me, and they were to listen to what we say, how clear are we in declaring the truth of God? That's our most important role here. We are ambassadors for God, and we beseech you, for Christ's sake, that you be reconciled to God. That has never changed. Whose voice are you? Are you going to let God tell you what he wants you to say. You don't have to wait for a registered letter. Just be acquainted with the book. Or are you allowing the world to speak its pagan philosophy through what you think, what you've gullibly swallowed as okay for today, but that which has never been approved by God ever? Christians, if you and I will stand up for the Lord, they will persecute us like they did Christ. But as he said to it was Ezekiel in the Old Testament, they're not going to listen to you, but they will know that there's a prophet in their midst. Isn't that great? He didn't call us to have success. He called us to be faithful. Will you do that? Shall we stand and close in prayer? Father, what great grace that you demonstrated when you looked ahead and saw that man's problem required a redeemer. What compassion when you sent your only son to die upon the cross to pay that price. What a privilege that you've given to us to represent you in a darkened and fallen world. And we simply pray that by your Spirit we will have the boldness and the strength to see things through, to faithfully stand for your truth, sometimes as the only source of how they hear the truth. We realize that it will not always be easy. We realize that many, maybe most, will reject. But there may be some that we look at and have occasion to give you praise, that you called another son or daughter to glory because your servant was faithful in standing for your truth. As we sow your seed, we pray that your Spirit will multiply the growth, multiply the harvest. We thank you for the privilege in Christ's name. Amen.